Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup.
So every day the shutdown continues to grow is another day that there will be a backlog.
This week, we're looking at the unexpected ways the government shutdown has impacted our food system.
There are nearly 1.6 million New Yorkers who rely on SNAP to feed themselves and their families every single day. There is a real impact on our friends and neighbors.
A lot of farmers rely on commodity loans at the end of the year. Since the offices are not open, those loans aren't available to them.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Why Food. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And we are, as always, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers in the food industry. And today we are joined by Alex McCurry and Jenny Goodman, who are the co-founders of Tillit, a fashion-forward hospitality workwear brand. Thanks for joining us.
You got it. Thanks
Happy
for having
to be
us.
Here.
So let's jump in with a little background. What is Tillit and how long have you been doing it?
Tillit is a, we just talked about this, I have a very hard time spitting out what we do. We're a workwear brand for hospitality professionals, and we've been doing it since November of 2012, so just over 6 years now.
So most people, when they go to the restaurant, they're used to seeing chefs wearing kind of the classic, like, not super well-fitting or kind of dirty-looking, like, almost scrub-like attire. So can you talk about what prompted you to say, like, oh my gosh, there's a hole in the market and this is how we're going to fill it?
Yeah, so we, I had worked in restaurants for a long time and was, you know, wearing that stuff. And working next to people who were wearing it. So you didn't really notice it quite as much. It was just kind of the garb that you wore to work.
Mm-hmm.
It had its function. It's, you know, the price point was fine. It was cheap. You could toss it after 3 months. And then as I had moved into private, you know, things were changing in the restaurant industry. And I was working in someone's home by myself. I was going out to the market and just I didn't feel proud to be in the clothes that I was wearing. I felt like I had a really cool job. I felt like the general public thought that being a chef was really awesome. And yeah. I was proud and, you know, the steps and the level that my career had gotten to. But I felt downright silly walking around in the clothes I was in.
Would you tell us the name of the individual in whose home you were working?
I worked for Jerry Seinfeld at the time. And so it was a great gig. And it was a lot of fun. And But again, still at the end of the day, it was like I felt kind of ridiculous in what I was wearing, and was, you know, it felt like that wasn't right. I felt like, and that I wasn't the only one. And so when we looked to see if other stuff was out there, it wasn't. And so we took a gamble and said, let's give it a shot.
How did you meet?
How did Alex and I meet?
Yeah.
So we met working at...
I mean, you can tell us how you met Jerry Seinfeld.
That's a more interesting story. No, we met working at Commander's Palace a million years ago, which feels like a million years ago now. I worked front of house and Alex worked back of house, and we're one of those like cliche couples, you know. But yeah, and I still feel like our roles are front of house and back of house.
And Alex, you continued to work in food, but Jenny, you didn't.
I didn't.
Tell us about your career after Commander's Palace.
Yeah, so after Commander's, I was in undergrad at Tulane at the time. I was working at Commander's. So I moved to New York and worked in pharma for 10 years doing, like, running huge clinical trials, which is basically like doing project management and research. And then Alex and I had a restaurant for about 6 months that opened and closed.
Oh, tell us more.
That's a whole other story. Yeah, we had a food truck called Goods on the corner of Lorimer Metropolitan, and we basically didn't have a business plan and just opened a restaurant, and our operating costs were crazy and we didn't know how to make it work. So we sold the business pretty quickly when we figured out that, hey, this is never going to make money. So that was that, which was crushing, but in a lot of ways, it was a really, really great lesson learned. And it's like you learn more from your failures than successes. And that was extremely true in this case. So after that, you know, I continued working in pharma. And then when the company started, I went back and got an MBA. So we actually both had full-time jobs, and I was in school, and we were starting a company. So that was fun.
Was the MBA helpful? You went to Stern.
I did.
Was the MBA helpful when you guys were thinking through the business plan, thinking through how to go to market, pricing strategy? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So thank you to all my Stern peers for doing live case studies on Tillit NYC. We thank you for your free advice, and my professors as well. It definitely was super helpful because neither one of us had a business background. So I was like the science nerd who studied neuroscience undergrad and then worked in that field. And Alex obviously was a chef and was very creative, but we proved to ourselves we didn't know how to run a business with opening and closing a restaurant in 6 months. So it definitely was an amazing experience in terms of getting live feedback on the company as we were developing it. And I learned a ton of things that we still apply to the business to this day.
What was the initial reaction when you first started telling people about your ideas? And kind of, this is a very like uncharted territory at that point, and people hadn't really seen, you know, they didn't know what they didn't know, like they didn't know what to expect. So what did they say?
I think reception was kind of, it was mixed a little bit, and, you know, obviously friends and family were supportive. But I feel like you can kind of read people when you tell them an idea and they're like, oh yeah, that sounds like
sure,
a great idea.
Right.
Fancy chef clothes. Like, you guys are going to kill it. yeah, I mean, at the time it sounded downright silly a little bit, but, you know, for somebody outside the industry or for, somebody without, you know, just the vision of kind of seeing what was inside my head, creatively. And that's always been a challenge for me is, you know, sharing what's creatively going on inside my head, for clothes and for product in that sense. But I think once we started, even though, you know, the line was super small, and things obviously weren't perfect in the very beginning, the response on the people that were wearing the stuff was great, and I think people, you know, were very happy to see that something different was being offered. And then, you know, chefs are a very, you know, particular and opinionated crew of career
chef's
folk. And
no.
They should be. I mean, that's what makes a great creative is being very strong about what you think the food should be or the chair in the restaurant should be. And so they were more than willing to share that opinion. And that certainly helped us go from who we were with three garments 6 years ago to who we are now and the business that we built.
Feedback's always been huge for us, and our customers being like brutally honest about what can make the product better. It's something we really take seriously, and it's helped us make a really good product today, for sure.
And not coming from fashion at all, how did you even know how to do any of this? How did you know how to sketch your first chef's coats or start with the manufacturing? Where did you start any of those processes?
I like to draw, so the sketching was okay. It wasn't professional. It certainly probably would have gotten me kicked out of FIT, but we were fortunate. I went to school with a girl that was working for Kate Spade at the time when we first moved to New York, and she introduced me to one of her coworkers, Whitney Posgay, who runs an amazing business now called Wit Fashion Line. And she kind of guided us through, you know, what the fashion industry in New York was all about and how we could make a few garments, how we could make a few samples. And so she introduced us actually to our pattern maker, who was an amazing Japanese workwear men's designer and had worked for many other fashion brands. And he, you know, kind of got my vision on my scribbled, you know, drawings of what the new chef coat or the new chef pants should look like and turned them into paper patterns that we then were able to turn into the first samples. And he actually introduced us then to the production person that we actually still use today, and that person has been an amazing mentor and kind of guided us through on, you know, everything from sourcing fabrics to production time and to kind of growing our production line in the way that we have been able to.
And another fun fact, Alex actually took sewing lessons.
Did do that. I forgot
yes.
about that.
Yeah, he did.
I'm a good sewer, too.
He can hem a pair of pants or two. Yeah. He can hem a pair.
In preparation for launching Tillit or unrelated? Were you?
No, in preparation. I wanted to understand, you know, what went into it. I had no intention, obviously, of sewing every garment that we made, but I wanted to understand, you know, what made up, you know, the garment and how, you know, how much time would it take and how detailed was it. And certainly gave me a new respect for the way that our clothes are made.
Yeah, for sure.
For the time it takes, the details that go into everything. It's the same as, you know, somebody going in a restaurant saying this is a great pizza here at Roberto's and having no idea how all this stuff came to shape, from finding the water and the flour and the right salt and the right tomatoes and all those things that go into it. If, you know, you don't really get to see that picture unless you do it yourself.
Can you talk us through the first ideas for like how your pants, the pants, the shirt and the apron would be different? Like the quality of the materials, the thickness of the materials, where the pockets would be. We were talking over earlier at lunch about like waxing some of the lining of the pants, just that process and how you decided these were the functions that you wanted to go for.
Yeah, so I think with every garment that we had designed and still do, I think our main goal is that it's functional. So the word utility is where we got our name from. So everything obviously has to be super functional. And in a kitchen, that means a lot of things. That means that it's going to stand up the test of time. It's going to take a huge beating because people, you know, work a lot of hours, work a lot of days.
It's not going to be too hot.
Right. It's got to be lightweight. Yeah. It's got to be as, you know, moisture wicking, as stain repellent as possible. And then it's got to be comfortable because you're wearing this stuff all the time. This is your primary clothing, you know, and you should put most of your effort into that. Now I forgot the question.
Any just technical things you were thinking right. about? Yeah.
So with the first pair of pants, I think telling you a little bit that they were kind of weird and they didn't really work, but it was a good test. I wanted the like kind of that durable look and feel of a pair of Carhartt pants. Mm-hmm. So we went with a canvas, but we wanted it to be lightweight enough to be in a kitchen. So we went with a much lighter weight canvas, which ended up ripping very easily. We put wax cotton on the pants, which drove the price up quite a bit, which didn't really work. We also put like in the bottom cuff of the pant, wax cotton so that you could roll it up at the end of your shift, clean the floors and still have some repellent nature on the bottom of your pants, which sounded like a great idea. But again, it added to the price. And then it also, we wouldn't be able to hem our pants to order, which we do now, which is a really nice benefit to the customer. So, mm-hmm. some of those things have changed over time.
So what are the pants now?
They're called totally different. Flex pants. Ethan is a fan. Thank you.
I wore them this past weekend. We cooked for 5,000 people wearing those pants.
The best Balkan festival. Right.
That's pretty cool. So now we actually, the pants have been one of the products that have definitely evolved, I think, the most over time. And again, based on like people's feedback. So they're called our Flex Pant now. And we actually had a fabric custom milled for us to have the right like stretch and poly and cotton sort of mix, because the poly helps it be fade resistant. The stretch helps it like have that great movement and all those kind of good things. So now they're like a slim cut. They have this great fabric that's super soft and super durable, has pockets in like great places. So one on the front and then one on the back of the leg. And it's actually like our second best-selling style across the line.
And what about, are the bottoms still like rollable or anything?
You can still roll them.
You can roll them, but they don't have the wax on them.
They don't have the wax. Yeah.
Maybe one day I'll figure that one out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cool idea, but it just, you know, it's one of those things that was like expensive. And then I'm like, people still bleach them. So then they still, you know, it's like when you're cleaning the floors at the end of the night.
And in addition to being business partners, you're also partners, life partners. Let's talk about that dynamic. Whose idea was this first, and what did the other one think of it, and how has your relationship evolved across the business?
Yeah, I mean, so I like to say we've never not been working together in some capacity. So we've always we met working in a restaurant. We've always been working together. Alex definitely was like, I have this crazy idea. You know, what do you think? And I was of course like, yeah. Let's do it. Like, go for it. Sounds great. No, I mean, I was very supportive, obviously, and thought it was a great idea from the get-go. And especially, like, I understood his struggle from, like, a personal level of, like, hey, I don't really like anything that I'm wearing. Like, he was, like, buying stuff from J. Crew and, like, Levi's. And I was like, but I don't look like a chef. I look like a normal person. And, like, you know, how do I marry those two things? And at the same time, like, I'm seeing we eat out a lot. We love food. We love dining. And I'm like, hey, there's every kitchen now is open and you can see what all the chefs are wearing and nobody looks good in their clothes because there's no good option. So to me, I was like, yeah, I believe in this vision. And we started, you know, I basically started helping him just because of like need or bootstrap business or savings went into this. Like we're fucked other
were you still working full-time
pharmaceutical exactly research? So we both actually had full-time jobs for the first, like, you left after
April of 13, so yeah. 5 or 6 months,
and then I left about a year after. So yeah, so at first we were both, you know, hustling.
And how do you divide responsibilities now?
We're pretty clear. I think that's one thing that is easy about, not easy, but I think is very like organic for us, is like I'm very focused on the business operations and like the sales side, and Alex is very focused on the product development, the design, and the production aspect. And we like obviously communicate about all of those things together, but we respect each other as leaders in those segments and sort of, you know, just trust one another to do it. So I think that's really been how we've functioned so nicely together in a partnership role.
Has it gotten easier over time?
Yes. I think the main reason is that we started out sharing our kitchen table as a desk. Our second office we shared.
I had a picture of it. I came across a picture of us literally like in our laptops with like bottles of wine on the table, looking stressed as fuck, like working on the laptops in our kitchen office. Yeah,
and then our second office. So that we were there for two years.
And home.
Our second office, we shared a desk again with two other people.
Only until we almost outgrew the space.
At the end,
At the end, it was us two, and then.
And now in the new office, we have our own desk, so it's
so nice.
A little bit of some space. Room.
Dreaming big. Can't wait for our own walled-in offices. No, I'm just kidding.
Do you have a specific advice for couples thinking about starting businesses together?
I think the biggest thing that makes us work is that we're on opposite sides of the office. We're in a figurative way, not in a literal way, but I think having different strengths and understanding those strengths, I think putting two people that are both creatives or two chefs in a kitchen, I haven't done it myself. I can't say it wouldn't work, but I certainly wouldn't necessarily encourage it. So, It's hard to each his own. You never know.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think now that we're, you know, I think the other thing is like making time for our relationship specifically outside of work. So like, you know, making sure we're doing stuff as like a family that's not work focused on the weekends. Like we try, now that we have more resources, we try to really like decouple from work on the weekend. And it's just like our family time, which is, I think, super, super important when you're living and working together.
And at what age is your daughter going to start working?
She's already, I'm like, I already call her the future
CEO.
She's
had the model before. She's
hustling. She has a cleaning set, like a little mop and broom set in the office. So she like comes and mops the floor.
How old is she?
She's two and a half.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I was doing anything useful at 2.5.
Awesome.
She really just moves stuff around on the floor.
Yeah.
I also want to talk a little bit about pricing strategy. We talked a little bit about this over lunch, but when you first started, it's always kind of this struggle for entrepreneurs of like, what price do I set these at? As you were saying earlier, Alex, it's as a creative, it's also really hard to value the time, your time of work. So how were you able to kind of come to grips with what to price your first clothing at, and how has that changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is something that like, and if I hadn't been in business school and had like done like a whole pricing strategy, you know, around this, I think it would have come out very differently. When we started, we were like 3 times more expensive than anything else on the market, and that was really crazy. But then we were like, hey, we're adding so much value that what currently is available doesn't have. It's the functionality, it's the great design, it's being able to wear this chef shirt that could be streetwear but is also professional, so you don't have to carry a whole set of clothes with you to have to change when you get to the restaurant. So we felt like if you have added value, if you can stand behind the quality and the durability of your product, which we do, then you can price it at what you think the market's willing to bear, and so that you can still have enough extra margin to reinvest in the business and keep it going. So it definitely was like a little scary when you come onto the market at 3 times the price of like what somebody was previously paying for an apron. But I think in a lot of ways it's paid off, and the psychology of the customer now has really changed. So there's not just our brand, but there's several other brands that are also making high-end aprons and different things where like together we've really lifted this tide where people are saying, I shouldn't be buying disposable stuff that doesn't look good on me. I should be buying something that's really quality that I'll wear for the next couple of years and it looks and feels really great.
Yeah, I think I was just going to say, I think it makes a big difference that we communicated, you know, why the price point was the price point. I think having transparency over why it cost what it did and what we would do to make it, you know, make that value sink in with the consumer. So we're another company that may charge $30 for a shirt, has a return policy that's 2 weeks long, and if you break it, tough shit, right? Mm-hmm. We stand behind products for a couple of years, and we, you know, actually try and invest in our customers and, you know, understand what they're going through. We come to their restaurants and eat their food and try and do things to sort of add that value in when we know that the price point has to be what it is just because of the fabrics that we're using and the way that we're ethically manufacturing and such as that. So,
do you feel the overall market for clothing has kind of shifted towards your mentality?
I think so. I think people are buying less and buying more quality. I mean, I look at my own personal shopping habits, and that's what I'm personally doing. I think that part of that is like the environment. Like people care about, hey, I don't want to just dispose of something. And I think disposable fast fashion is, you know, a little bit on the wane. And I think consumers are really educated now in all aspects of things. So I think they can see and feel the difference between something that's really quality and rather invest in that product. For sure.
I was going to ask something. I just totally lost it. I think one of the things that distinguishes your line to me is the very particular, the details.
Yeah.
On the chef's coat, for example, there's a little clip on the back for the apron strap to go through, and the side pocket for your cell phone on the pants so that you don't have to reach underneath your apron to get to your phone. How do you come up with those details? It seems like there's a very particular, it must be a particular process. How do you think of those ideas?
They've all kind of come in their own way. I think the apron tab is a funny, maybe it's not funny at all, I don't know, but I'll tell the story. you decide, I guess. But the apron tab was actually a recommendation request from Mads Refslund at the time he was at Acme. and we were making them custom aprons and custom shirts. And he previously in Copenhagen had had a uniform that had this apron tab on the back and wanted us to put it on our shirt. And that was probably 5.5, 6 years ago. It was pretty early in the company.
That was, we were the first U.S. company to do it, so I still regret not patenting it in the U.S. Is
that like a thing now?
Everyone does it. But again, we're like, thank you.
But we changed the industry. So we changed the industry, so we're like, take comfort in knowing that we like really did something for the better in that sense. And that was one of the first things I feel like that we saw that everybody copied us. And at first you're like, why are you doing this? And then you're like, oh, that's pretty flattering that the biggest, the biggest chefware company in all of North America is stealing our designs. That's, mm-hmm. In a way, that's kind of cool.
Has that been an issue at all? Like, it feels like some of the, we don't need to name by name, but the bigger companies have kind of moved towards supposedly the ethos of better quality, more function, and at least looking nicer the last few years. I have my own feelings about if they're doing that well, but
I mean, I think that, you lead by being a leader. So like for us, we're doing things as we think they should be done. And we're, trying to keep on making collections and new products that we think people want. So like, that's sort of our philosophy on it. And again, we're so happy that we're changing an industry that hadn't been changed in 20 years and that there's more options for everybody working in this industry more than anything else.
We started because those guys hadn't evolved in 25 years. Yeah. Basically, it was the exact same clothes. It was the exact same pants. They were cut like giant pajama pants that would fit literally someone as small as you to the biggest person on the block with the exact same pair of pants, which is asinine when you think about it. And so for us to have had some influence in making these guys evolve for the greater good of everyone is awesome. Obviously, we wish they wouldn't be acting maybe like in an Urban Outfitters sort of style, but what are you gonna do?
And for us, it pushes us harder to like keep on creating, and that's like the biggest thing. Is like, I think competition's great because it makes you be like, get off your ass, keep on doing cool shit over and over again, so that you can make sure you keep on evolving.
Can I put in a request for a technical detail?
Yes.
Yeah,
where it's like tweezers that go horizontally. I'm sorry if you're
Jenny and her tweezers.
Me and my tweezers. It's
not
like,
at an angle, but actually horizontal.
I mean, maybe at an angle. I guess at a slight angle, because every time I bend over, it like falls out of your pocket.
Goes over.
Yeah,
we may be working on an apron with a more horizontal pocket.
Not directly horizontal. We'll take that under.
We'll take that under consideration.
A constant problem.
Actually have the Ripstop has a side entry pocket.
We do have,
but it's not a small.
Not small enough for
stitch for a tweezer to hold tight, but it is a side entry.
Even tweezers and pens. That's like always my problem.
Yeah.
What happens if you lean to the right?
Yeah, I guess right. If you lean. Yeah, but
maybe
we'll
send you some things to test.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's how we do R&D.
That's how it happens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That happens.
Let's talk about that as well. Feedback, R&D, what does that process look like? And how many samples of something do you test out before you say, let's do 100, 500 of these?
Yeah, that's definitely been something that's really evolved for us. So, I mean, when we were a young company and we didn't have the resources to keep on iterating on samples, we would just sort of put it into the market and, ask for feedback and survey people and all those kind of good things. And now we make samples and we tweak them and we wear them. All of our samples happen to be mine and Alex's sample size. So everybody's like, your jumpsuit fits you so well. I'm like, I was the fit model. So now we definitely, like for the jumpsuit, for example, I think we went through 6 samples before we actually launched the product, and it took us about 9 months of product development. To get the fit right, to get the feel right, to get the placement right. And there's still stuff that we change on it. Like we did a large button on it for the first production run, and we were like, it's gapping a little bit in some places. Let's use a smaller button and put them closer together and add another button on the second production run. So there's still little tweaks that even after all that R&D, you still want to like make to constantly improve the product.
And the jumpsuit wound up in Vogue magazine.
Yeah.
Tell us that story.
That was a product that a lot of people, like just in regular fashion, we saw like chefs and stuff starting to wear. And I personally own probably 20-something jumpsuits, I'm embarrassed to say. It's the ultimate uniform. Mm-hmm. I mean, you like look really good from start to finish. And so it was like a personal passion project for both Alex and I. So yeah, we felt like it was the one ultimate uniform, the uniform for all. So we did a fun like photo shoot campaign with it where we shot a bunch of different people in different aspects of the hospitality industry, and then Vogue picked it up. So cool.
And was that what does that say about your brand, or how did that represent a change maybe in the way that your brand has grown?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we've always thought of our brand as like a fashion brand, but for people in hospitality. And I think that the jumpsuit in like specifically has changed, has like made everybody be like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. You're like, that is really something that you can wear anywhere. And like,
well, I think that, yeah. And that like recognition to be in vogue with a chef's uniform is basically, you know, culmination of the idea that we had in the very beginning, was to make the uniform so cool that people felt proud to be in it. And yeah, when you're in your uniform in the pages of Vogue magazine, like, how could you not feel good about that?
So yeah, mission accomplished. So, you can walk away.
In a sense, I would say. Yeah.
We're done. We're done. Yeah. We did our thing. And then, and actually Missy Robbins wore it in Vanity, and like she was in Vanity Fair like the following month wearing it.
Oh,
that, yeah. And cool. That was really huge too. And a lot of people saw Missy in Vanity Fair, and that was also the same thing. It's like Missy legit wears the jumpsuit every single night at her restaurants, but
she has a lot of them. She doesn't wear the,
she doesn't
same,
wear the same one. She has a lot of them, more than I have of them. But yeah, but just, I mean, she was shot in a magazine in her home also wearing it. And so that to me really like was a good.
Are there any customers who buy your products who don't work in hospitality?
Yes, for sure. Actually, we keep on talking about the jumpsuit, but that product specifically, we've had a lot of artists come in and be like, I saw it in Vogue, I saw it here, like, I want this jumpsuit, I'm a ceramicist or whatever.
We also do some uniforms for like hairdressers, and we do, yeah, we do quite a few hotels. So we do anything from housekeeping to front desk to whatever, engineers and engineers, all kinds of.
I wore your kitchen pants hiking through the jungles that of is Tanzania.
True. Oh, yeah. That is so yeah, true. I love yeah, that. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and their rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
And welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
Today, we're joined by Jenny Goodman and Alex McCreary, the co-founders of Tillit. We were just talking about design, fashion, how their jumpsuit, which was designed for hospitality, has made it into Vogue and Vanity Fair. So it's been an interesting conversation.
And Jenny, you used to work in fashion, didn't you?
I did for a brief period of time. I worked in fashion consulting. So my main clients were fast retailing after they bought Theory. So I worked mostly out of Theory and had to actually do a lot of samples, had to do a lot of sourcing and supply chain for them. And it was quite a ride. Yeah. I had to like track down a lot of lost fabric overseas for a while. And that was fun. There was like $2 million of black fabric of different varieties that was just lost. We also had like
did
a
did you find it?
No.
still lost.
The best was being able to like go through like sample fittings. Well, I was not being sample fitted. Everybody was like tall and very thin. but just seeing like the parade of people coming in for sample fittings. And we at the best story that I have, though, is that because we worked above the retail store, I ended up netting a loss every month because we got such a good discount. I would go down and shop during my lunch hours.
Not all part good. Of the plan.
I think so. Reinvesting in the company.
Reinvesting. I love that.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about creativity in kitchens and creativity in fashion. Are there, what's different? What's similar? What did you learn about creating and following a vision in restaurants that you've been able to apply to Tillit?
I think that the hardest part or the biggest difference of creating fashion versus food is that you have a much longer lead time before you get to try on your goods. And then it can be quite a bit more expensive to get through an idea when it's a garment. By the time you can change a dish, 20 times in a week probably.
Yeah.
To kind of perfect it and get the details right. To do that with a garment would be very expensive and would probably take you 6 months. So I think there's a bit more research that needs to happen before you actually take the idea into some stage of production, whether it's just sampling. Whereas, obviously in the kitchen you can play with stuff at very low risk. I think the risk is higher. The creativity is still able to be free. I think it just makes you a little more cognizant of the risk involved with taking it to that next level, the actual prototype or the sample.
You mentioned something about a pizza print over lunch.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that sort of creativity looks like too?
Yes. I mean, a lot of times we take things that are like inspiration and what's happening with what's happening in popular culture, what's happening in life, what's happening around our office. So since the inception of Tillit, we've done Pizza Fridays. So every chef loves pizza. This one, I'm pointing to Alex, included. So we literally eat pizza. Like sometimes there's a mutiny in the office. They're like, oh, not another Pizza Friday. But for the most part, everybody...
Who would complain about Pizza Friday?
No one complains to Alex.
There's whispers, okay? It's part of our company culture, essentially. And so we made a digital pizza print. It's really a tiny little tiny pizzas. And we actually had it custom printed on fabric. And then we took one of our best-selling shirt styles, which is our French Kitchen Work shirt, and we printed it on it. So that is coming to you in early February. Stay tuned for the launch.
May or may not be coincided with National Pizza Day.
And we may or may not have a pizza party at the office.
Check your Instagram calendar.
Oh.
Do you have a favorite pizza place?
Oh, yeah, where are the ordering pizzas from?
I mean, we're sitting in a pizza place, so I'm not sure I feel comfortable answering that question.
We love a lot of different pizza places.
We
don't discriminate. We typically order from either Scars. Yeah. Our offices are in the Lower East Side. So we order a lot from Scars because they're our neighbors, and they're also just doing cool shit. They're milling their own flour, and they're it's really good. And you can taste the difference, but it looks like a regular New York slice, but it's not. It's so good. And we also love Prince Street when people feel like
walking. There's been a lot of drama over Prince Street lately, though, so I don't know.
Prince Street drama. You guys heard about this?
No.
No?
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. I'll let you read the article
before
I put this on the air.
Yeah. All right.
So we love Prince Street. We love Speedy Romeo. There's a lot of pizza places we love.
Roberto's,
of course. We just had a couple of other pizzas for lunch.
Yeah.
What's your culinary style? What were your favorite things to cook, Alex?
So I'm from New Orleans, so obviously I have a good bit of that cuisine in my blood. And then, I spent 3 years at Commander's Palace down there. So that was kind of where, I learned that I wanted to be. I learned the majority of what I feel like I took with me in far as technique and the ability to work with other people and working under people, working over people. I learned how to put a lot of food out in a short amount of time at that restaurant.
It's a big place.
It's huge. Yeah. Restaurant.
I mean, there's days when you do 1,500 covers between lunch and between brunch and dinner. It's crazy.
Yeah. That's insane.
And then I came to New York and worked in a much, much smaller kitchen with a lot less seats. It was very, very different and unusual, but... again, I lost the question.
What do you like to cook?
What do you
cook these days?
I love
macaroni and cheese for a 2.5-year-old who doesn't eat anything but white food.
Yeah, it's a mix of obviously kid-friendly food now with the baby and And we eat much healthier, obviously, than we used to, aside from my, you know, very frequent pizza splurges for lunch. We eat really healthy at home. And so I like more of like a Mediterranean sort of fresh, healthy vibe. But
one of the things both of you mentioned earlier, too, was ethical sourcing, making sure that everyone in the supply chain is being paid fairly and just treated well. Can you talk about that and how you're also balancing that with, you know, price points and demand and all that?
Yeah. So we work with with the same manufacturer that we started with. The majority of our collection is manufactured like here in New York. And that was really important to us from the beginning, to just really, like, you want to know where your food comes from, you want to know where your fabrics come from, and those kind of things. So, I mean, there's definitely things you can do to push price down by getting huge discounts or going to certain places overseas where you aren't sure about how things are being made and you just know what the landed cost is. So for us, it's like we would rather know our manufacturers, see the factory, know that the workers are being paid fair wages, and have to pay a little bit more and charge a little bit more for it. So that was, you know, something that we sort of felt strongly about, regardless of where we're manufacturing from the beginning.
Was that a challenging sales pitch? Did people get that, or how have people's reactions to that changed in the years you've been operating?
Yeah, I mean, I think we, like, people ask, like, why is it so expensive? And that's what we explain, you know, why are you charging more? I'm like, well, because we're buying really high quality, like, fabrics that a lot of them are milled here. We use a lot of eco-friendly fabrics that are made of recycled fabrics, which is actually, you know, a more extensive and intensive process that costs things, that makes things cost more. And I think, again, like, I think our consumer is more educated and cares more these days. So I, most part, people are okay with it.
You're also starting to foray into other non-clothing items. There was a bartender's backpack that came out, and we were talking a little bit about shoes over lunch. Can you talk about the process of going into this new territory? Is it a completely different process? Can you use the same manufacturers, or you just have to start over?
I think with those, we've tried to basically find really good partners. And so, you know, I think that at this point, we would say we're fairly skilled in the complexities of manufacturing clothing. To do that with, say, a bag or a backpack or a pair of shoes, would basically be starting all over and going through the hurdles that we went through already, you know, as a young business, and having mistakes and having, you know, functional issues is not really something that we're interested in at the moment. So I think the best way to do it is to, you know, find someone who's amazing at making a bag and then work with them. And so that's what we did with both our chef backpack, which we've had now for, I think, 4 years.
3 years,
yeah. And our bartender backpack, which we just released in November-ish. Mm-hmm. So we work with a company called Hex Brand, who's based out in California, and they have kind of like a street tech style line of backpacks and shoulder bags, and they do a really nice job and have a really great attention to detail. And so when we went to them with the idea, they were super supportive and thought it was a great idea, and they even invested in some stock to sell themselves. So they were really invested in the product and in the design of it, and have been able to make it at a decent price that we can land it to our consumer base, who needs to be able to have a very functional bag for the right price.
What's the difference between the two bags?
There's a lot of difference.
Yeah, there's a lot of difference. I mean, what the chef carries is fairly different than the bartender. The chefs are carrying tools, you know, long, thin, very dangerous tools,
sharp,
right?
So, yeah.
One of the biggest things that's in the chef backpack is that the entire knife slot area is lined with super fabric, which is basically like a fabric like Kevlar. It's not Kevlar, it's something similar, but it's basically you can't puncture through it. So it's, and the first one that we made, you know, we made the flap go from right to left as opposed to top to bottom. And when we like shook it around and like did all these like crazy, silly tests, like some of the knives poked through the top.
We're like, oh no.
Frightening.
I was like, we don't have product liability insurance that high.
So there's little tweaks like that. So then we made like one solid flap of the super fabric go top to bottom so that there's no way it's coming out. And then on the chef's, or the bartender's bag is, you know, it's actually two pieces. So this one has a essentials kit is what we call it. And that's a piece that you can put in a couple of shakers, a glass, stirrers, jiggers, I'm still like strainers. I'm getting all my bar tools like memorized now after having done the bartender bag. And we worked with Eamon Rocky, who's a fairly well-known bartender in New York, and he kind of guided us through, obviously, what a bartender needs in the moment, what a bartender needs to carry to work or to an offsite event. And so it can hold everything from like 3 bottles of booze, all your tools, change of clothes, pair of shoes, laptop, iPad.
Oh, wow.
Tons of stuff. Yeah. You can carry it as a backpack. You can carry it sideways as a briefcase. You can put a cutting board in it. It's really got like a ton of uses. You can put anything you can imagine in there.
In the last few minutes of the podcast, we like to do a rapid fire, less formal, more fun segment. So we're going to throw a bunch of questions at you, and it's going to be very high pressure, I promise. Whoever feels like answering them first, just go for it. Let's start with, if you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
Taking care of a toddler.
I would agree with that.
is that a skill you're in the process of?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're losing that battle.
We're losing that battle at the moment.
I don't think any parent wins that.
Yeah, it's an ongoing battle.
It's a lost cause.
What is your favorite thing to eat, or what was your favorite thing to eat for lunch when you were growing up?
Pizza. Easy.
What are your pizza toppings?
Pepperoni.
Just straight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Classic. Purist.
I used to eat bagels, cream cheese, like all day long. I guess I'm the reason why my child likes white food. I don't know.
Was it a flavored cream cheese?
No, I would like everything bagels with plain cream cheese. That's like, I hate that for lunch.
How do you feel about pizza bagels?
I feel okay about a pizza bagel.
Again, we don't discriminate.
Yeah.
If there's pizza involved, it's fine.
It's fine. Cool.
What's the best meal you've ever had that cost less than $10?
I would say the laksa in Penang.
That was the best meal ever?
For under $10 for sure. Yeah. It was like $2 and it was the complexity. I mean, we ate like all the street food when we were in Penang in Malaysia, and it like, I would say the laksa like blew my mind because like had so much.
Yeah, we did. We went back to the same place
like 3 times.
Yeah, laksa is like a coconut based curry soup.
It's like a coconut based curry soup. And they do a lot of tamarind in the one in Penang specifically, which added like a whole another interesting dimension.
They put like lettuce in the bottom of the bowl before they put it in, which seemed really counterintuitive to anything that you would have here. Like,
and they use 2 kinds of noodles. So they use an egg noodle and a rice noodle in Penang, which was like...
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it was like so
real attention to detail.
Exactly.
They had it down.
They had it really down. I would say that would be the best under 10.
What's the best book you've read recently?
Oh, I wish there was time to read a book.
I'm currently reading Shoe Dog, but I haven't... halfway through.
My husband is reading or read that book recently. He's been on a mission.
Yeah.
What is it?
Shoe Dog.
From the founder of Nike.
Yeah.
Any lessons applicable to tell it?
I mean, you know, it's like a true entrepreneurial story. Same, you know, it's inspiring to read. I mean, he's like, was this young guy who just really loved running and was like, hey, there's nothing functional out there for running. I mean, yeah.
And he failed multiple times.
Failed
almost
multiple times.
Almost lost the company multiple times. Had to dig himself out. So it's really been up and down. So it's kind of nice, reassuring that you're not the only one totally flailing out there.
Yeah, they're doing all right, Nike, right?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. At last I heard.
How do you like your eggs in the morning? What's your favorite way to prepare eggs?
I cook breakfast every morning, and that's the only meal I cook. I scramble the eggs. Make a mean scrambled egg.
Do you have a particular technique? Milk?
No milk.
I don't know. Any?
Whip it real good before
you
start.
Lots of butter. She puts a lot of butter.
I push
a lot.
I think that's always the quote-unquote secret to good eggs. Yeah. Is just
I
butter.
Put a lot of butter. Yeah. I know. He's always like, you're going to put some eggs without butter? But, you know, whatever. It's good.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be? Not the toddler.
I would be invisible.
Invisible?
Yeah. What would you do with your power of invisibility?
I would not have to talk to anyone. If I didn't want to, I could just like turn it off. Like, I'm not even here.
Would you wear clothes while you were invisible?
Well, I guess it depended on like if you just like popped in and out of invisibility. Right. I'm not sure, but probably not.
Right now, I'd say I would like to be able to fly so I don't have to take the freaking JMZ or L train every day.
Mm-hmm. very practical. Yeah. I feel like this is a... I'm trying to draw some conclusion about the nature
like
of our partnership.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a pretty good tell of the nature of our relationship.
She wants to fly and I just want to be non-existent.
But she wants to fly only so that she can avoid taking the subway.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not an exploration. It's not to travel the world.
I know.
Just to avoid the
JMC. Just to get to work faster.
Right. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you for joining us. Where can our listeners find you and find your clothing?
Yeah, online at tillitnyc.com, on Instagram at tillitnyc. And if you are local to New York, please come and visit our showroom at 319 Grand Street on the corner of Grand and Orchard. We have beer on tap and bubble water and coffee. So there might be about 10 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in the office.
Oh, right now, so, of like, what kind?
We're into the Thin Mints and the...
Tagalongs and Samoas. Yeah.
I'll be there like right after the show.
Yeah, lots of
for the next
come
to
visit. Besides pool clothes.
try on an apron and eat a box and a half of Girl Scout.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. And
Thank you for having us.
This was so fun.
Yeah.
And as always, you can find us at Why Food Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And please email us if you have questions for Jenny and Alex or want to nominate someone else. We're at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
You can find me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And I'm at Chef Jenny Dorsey. We'll see you next week.
We were face to face and back to my back. Went to a place that only I can know.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.